Science Unscripted.
Hello and welcome to Science Unscripted. It's Connor here.
And Gabe.
We have emails for you. Quite a few. And one of them, Gabe, you said you hadn't seen it. I printed it up for you. I'm passing it over now. You're going to know, or I'm going to know. Everyone's going to know whether you have or haven't seen this email by the time you're finished reading it. It's from Megan.
Hi there. I'm not entirely sure how to begin this email, but I do hope you're both well. Early morning listener here in Canada from the Eastern Rocky Mountains. I caught your story about good deeds helping ease the transition into uni, but specifically the part about no Vancouverites picking up any litter for the duration of the study.
This, by the way, real quick, this was
that,
our...
Yeah, that got a lot of attention.
Yeah, the study was on how, if you measure how many good deeds, altruistic, small, day-to-day deeds people are doing, that it correlates with levels of well-being.
Yeah.
It's like a barometer of your well-being.
And there was a side remark you made about during the study that one of the... or none of those good deeds...
None of the participants in the study...
included picking up trash on the streets of Vancouver.
They never once picked up trash, and that surprised me.
Yeah. Your litter bug tidbit flashed through my mind a couple of hours later while I was out on the mountain trails with my huskies and spied an errant granola bar wrapper. I actually initially walked 10 feet past, but circled back to pick it up, specifically thinking of what I just learned from you two. I full-handed grabbed the wrapper and crinkled up, then tried to find my jacket pocket so I could throw it out when I got home. Except it was full of human poop. What? Full. Granola bar sized. Someone had used it as toilet paper and left it right beside the tree. I had smashed it all over my jacket while trying to open my pocket with the same hand. I had that moment in my head where I was trying to rationalize that maybe the stickiness was just the fruit filling the bar. And you're smelling your fingers before your brain had the chance to scream, no! I'm not blaming you. I was just so disappointed in humanity this morning. But now that I've washed with bleach and gotten the stink up my hand, it's starting to be a little humorous, if not a cautionary tale. I'm not saying this is related at all to why no one was picking up litter in Vancouver. It's just to show what kind of reach your show has. Kindly, Megan.
We're so sorry, Megan. We really are. I really am.
So wait, she doesn't pick the granola bar up if we hadn't mentioned that. If you hadn't mentioned that, Connor.
This is causation. We caused Megan to bend over or to double back, reach down, grab a granola wrapper that unexpectedly was filled with human feces. Oh my.
How about the clown who fills a granola bar wrapper
with...
Why not just go... He's out in the trails in the Canadian Rockies.
Yeah.
Just go behind a tree or something.
Well, most people do that, but what I usually look out for, especially on very, very high traverse trails here in Germany, are little spots of toilet paper. It's an indication that somebody's gone back there and done something and they left the toilet paper and you can see it. So it's actually a visual cue. Uh-oh, watch out for that. This sounds like somebody didn't have toilet paper, didn't want to use a leaf. Maybe not knowing if, I don't know what kind of poisonous or bushes are out there.
And so a granola bar wrapper, man?
I know. And then use that, and maybe the wind blew it closer to the trail. Maybe they left it near the trail. I'm really sorry, Megan. That's an unexpected...
But please keep listening and writing in, because that is just you got a command of the English language. That was hilarious.
I felt that experience.
Whew.
I felt that experience. One other email to mention here, real quickly, connected to that topic. And it was about, actually, there were a couple emails about how some people have potentially stopped picking up litter or picking up trash as a result of COVID.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of fear initially that COVID was
No, people really latched onto that topic.
Yeah, primarily transmitted via surfaces. Later, we all learned that it was transmitted primarily through the air, aerosols.
Yeah.
But that feeling has stuck, and that might be part of it. And then one of the emails talked about how in the city, once that listener, I forget if it was a man or a woman, moved to the city, they stopped picking up litter. Mm. And that reminded me of that same thing, but in reverse. So living in the city, living in Cologne, when I first moved to Germany, it's a big city. You've got some trash. You've got stuff all over. And you don't pick any of that up. I now live in a more suburban area, and if there's trash, I do pick it up. I think there's a difference in whether or not you do it if you're in the big city, where you might be overwhelmed by it, so you never... Why would you start?
Yeah.
As opposed to living in suburbia, where you think, okay, this is actually making a difference.
I'm pretty aloof to trash. My wife, that is one of the pro-social things that she does often. Whenever we go out walking by the Rhine River or up in the hills here in the Westerwald...
But it's worth it there. It's worth
it
there.
Yeah.
You're not. You can stop it. You can make a difference.
Of course.
It feels like it.
Yeah.
Just real quickly, one email from a longtime listener about the idea of do animals have pets?
Mm-hmm.
And she mentioned Coco the gorilla as an example. Coco, this gorilla made famous for being quote unquote taught sign language. That's a controversial, much discussed topic still. To what extent that animal learned any kind of language at all. But one thing that did happen was in July of 1984, Coco the gorilla was presented with a litter of kittens and chose one and named it All Ball,
I think.
Based on, again, this sort of
sign language.
Invented language. Treated it well, had a nice time with it until in December, so not long later, 5 months later, the kitten escaped and got hit and killed by a car, unfortunately. Mm. And I would say that's not quite the example we were looking for, close but not quite, because it was entirely created, the whole situation, by
man-made.
Yeah, by humans. And going back to the question of do animals in the wild keep pets, nice email from longtime listener Mark, who lives out in the rainforest of the Pacific Northwest.
See, I don't get Mark's emails. They land in my spam folder.
Well, he sends us a lot. Yeah, I get them. I read them. I read them all, Mark. I love your emails. Keep sending them.
Man, I gotta fix that.
Yeah, he includes a lot of artwork or copy-pasted art. I love him. Anyway, the only part of this email that I thought was relevant, I thought it was a good point. He said he contradicted the idea that ants keep aphids as pets.
Hmm.
We talked about it in the last show. It was to ultimately to get nectar, and he was saying that that's not what that is. They are farm animals that they milk.
Hmm.
And that is probably a more apt description of the relationship that's happening there. It's not a loving, nurturing, pro-social relationship. It's quid pro quo.
Hmm.
And just in the same way that we keep dairy cows.
The aphid latches on, gets some nectar. And the ants, you said honeydew, right?
Yeah, they excrete a sweet substance. And the ants make sure that these aphids are protected from predators. And they kind of herd them into the right areas.
Otherwise, they don't get milked.
Yeah, it is milking. These are cow. Yeah, this is a dairy farm, just with the different animal species. I thought that was a fair point to bring up. Yeah, let's go to the science.
You first?
Yeah, I got a study, and it's not really about anything German at all, except for the word in the title of the study. It's one of the best or most used German words in the English language, and this is
Blitzkrieg.
No, I thought maybe rucksack. Or, I don't know.
Birkenstock.
I'm wearing those right now.
I know.
Pretty comfy. It's warm right now. No, it's Schadenfreude.
Ah.
Schadenfreude.
Spontaneous definition of that term is the pleasure that I would derive from your pain.
Misfortune. Yes. Or, and not just...
A Schaden is damage to you, and Freude would be the joy that I get because of your... Yeah, you're Schaden.
Yeah, so if something bad happens to someone else and you actually get joy out of it, you are feeling Schadenfreude. It's going to happen with somebody personally, you know. It could happen with a politician or somebody famous, but I think everyone has kind of felt this at some point. Joy at someone else getting knocked down a peg, finally. Mm-hmm. So what this study was about was charitable donations, and that may seem odd. Right, like, how are you connecting misfortune to donating money? But that's exactly what they tried to figure out. This was the University of California looking into the $500 billion just in the U.S. alone that are donated annually, and trying to determine, like, look, if you want to raise money,
yeah,
how can
so if you're feeling Schadenfreude for someone and then you donate to it, or to that person that you're feeling schadenfreude for?
Kind of. What's going on? Yeah, you're closing in on it. What they did, and they did it in survey form, they had imagined scenarios.
Yeah.
And what they determined is if you're holding a fundraiser, you want to raise money, and you want to extract the most you can out of the people who could potentially donate, that is kind of the goal. One of the best things you can do is to elicit that schadenfreude in them in a constructive way. And specifically, you take someone that they would like to see, I don't know, tricked or teased, or the specific examples were, like, you know when somebody's sitting up on a dunk tank?
Yeah.
And you throw a ball and then they fall into the dunk tank. They
get
soaked. Yeah.
So that's an example of schadenfreude. Right?
That's an example of schadenfreude. And what you do, or the way to, in the study, they were asked whether they were going to donate like $0 or up to $10 for a specific cause. Mm-hmm. It has to be mild pain, like a dunk tank, like a pie in the face to someone else, a bucket of ice water dumped on someone's head. And importantly, the person has to kind of deserve it. That's critical here. So they have to be, let's say you're working in an institution or you're doing a fundraiser for a school.
Okay.
The kids at the school, and by association, their parents, might be kind of fearful of the principal of the school, the director.
All right.
They have a reputation for being super strict.
Yeah.
And you want to raise money for the school. Maybe there's a library that's being built, something.
But you hate the principal.
Everyone kind of is fearful of or would get some joy out of seeing something happen to that principal.
And something's going to happen to this principal now.
So the principal is the one who goes up on the dunk tank.
Got it.
Or gets the pie in the face or the bucket of water. They also created fake scenarios where that maligned person got an extreme consequence. I think the example was
like an electric shock.
Yeah, they got shot with a taser.
No.
And in that case, the donations dropped off because people are like, no, that's too much. Don't do that. That doesn't make me feel schadenfreude. That makes me feel sadness, empathy for somebody I don't...
Bertolt Brecht, a German playwright, early 20th century, wrote a play called The Three Penny Opera.
Yeah.
And in that opera, there's a song sung by a homeless person or someone living rough. And he's trying to teach this other person, this other guy on the street, living rough, how to make the most money, how to get people to give.
Mm-hmm.
And he tells them it's not about being liked. Don't be liked. It's not, you don't want that person to like you. You want them to pity you.
Maybe that's connected.
There could be a connection there.
Yeah. No, that's it. Kind of similar here. The key, I'll repeat the key takeaway for anyone out there who's about to participate in a fundraiser or hold a fundraiser for whatever good cause.
Yeah.
Mild misfortune on deserving targets.
Mild misfortune on deserving targets. Not
with
a taser.
Yeah, if you want to read more about it, it's called The Ironic Impact of Schadenfreude, mm-hmm. When the Joy of Inflicting Pain Leads to Increased Pro-Social Behavior.
Oh. This one is for the somewhere between 600 and 800 million people around the world.
That's a lot of, that's...
Who suffer from lower back pain.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah.
This is, I did not know this. This is the number one cause of disability on our earth.
Number one, the
number one reason why you will miss time at work or take time off at work because of a disability is for lower back pain.
Lower back pain. Yeah. Not upper back, lower back.
Lower back pain. And then what they were looking at in this study in Australia, the University of Malarkey, was...
Are you serious?
That's the name of the university.
Malarkey?
Yeah.
Malarkey, at least in American English, is nonsense.
No, I got
it. Quit talking malarkey to me. I'm not trying to make fun of this university at all. I have to confirm whether...
Sorry, it's Macquarie.
Macquarie.
So it was malarkey what I was...
Oh, it wasn't the...
It's Macquarie.
It wasn't the University of Nonsense?
This study is not nonsense, Connor.
Okay.
Bear with me. Two groups, 350 in each group, and all 700 of these people had lower back pain and recovered from it.
Mm-hmm.
And this study was looking to find out what can you do to increase the time it takes until the next instance of back pain comes back.
The event.
The recurrence.
Yeah.
Because if you have ever had lower back pain, you know you don't want it to come back.
It's horrible.
It's really important.
Yeah, I've had it. You've had it?
Yeah. And there have been studies on this, and the conclusion is that you have to work out. You have to do some kind of fitness. This study was looking at walking. What does walking do to when the recurrence of back pain will happen, and it halves it? In one group,
it reduces it by 50%.
By 50%. The intervention group did 6 months of walking, and it started with just short walks, 5 minutes. The goal was to have them five times a week walk for 30 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
So that's 2.5 hours a week. The other group did nothing, and they wanted to see, obviously, when the recurrence would happen. In the group that did the walking, it was 112 days. In the group that didn't do anything, it was 208 days.
So there was still recurrence?
There was recurrence in both groups?
In both groups, but it delayed it by, in this case, it extended it by twice the amount that it would have been.
Yes.
It was twice the amount that it would have been.
And all these people did was walk. What they ended up doing, the average time they spent walking per week was around 2 hours. So the goal was 2.5 hours.
Not close.
Five times a week.
2 hours is good.
30 minutes, you just go walking. What they had a coach to keep them walking and to teach them about back pain. So it wasn't just the walking. Because a year after the study, they followed these people for 3 years to check on them. A year after the study, they were walking 2.5 hours at 6 month mark. And by 1 year, they were walking the same as the control group. Yeah. And at 1 year, the number of injuries because of that went up in the intervention group.
Hey, of course.
But not in the lower back, in the legs.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah. So the name of the game is endurance. Whatever you do, if you want to try this therapy for lower back pain, it will work, but you got to keep doing it.
Well, it has to be sustainable. Whatever your program is, it could be an hour a week.
Right.
If that's going to work for you, do that. Don't overextend and think I can suddenly do 5 hours a week immediately.
The lead author of the study, I'll just quote him here at the end, said, you don't need to be walking 5 or 10 kilometers every day to get the benefits, because the benefits are real. The important thing is to remember is to start with short walks and then gradually increase the distance and intensity as your fitness improves. Don't go at it too hard at first because you will drop off. And good luck. Back pain is horrible.
Well,
debilitating.
My mom's
going through it right now. I know it. You know it.
And what I like about that therapy, it's free. You don't need to go to the gym. You don't need weights.
Everyone can do it.
Anyone can do it. And in addition, I think there's like an evolutionary biological logic for that working. Because we have evolved to walk upright and yet a lot of and stay upright for long periods of time. And a lot of us like just like right now, Gabe, what were we doing? We're sitting up in the office. I guess we walk down here, but now we're sitting again. We sit so much.
Yeah.
And just by going back to what we were probably doing 5,000 years ago, it would improve things.
Well, the prevalence of back pain since 1990 has gone up by 50%.
Hmm.
It's going up. By 2050, I said before, between 600 and 800 million. That 800 million is the estimate by 2050.
Mm-hmm. Keep moving.
Just go for a walk. And what was your first one? It's been so long ago since you did it.
If you're trying to raise money and you hold a fundraiser, take the least liked person who's connected with the fundraiser.
Yeah.
Put them on a dunk tank and get them soaked, or dump ice on their head, but make it contingent upon other people donating first.
Do not use a taser.
Don't tase them. Don't electrocute them.
Okay.
Don't light their hair on fire. Don't do anything that is really harmful for human beings.
Because then nobody's going to donate.
Yeah. And lastly, we're sorry again, Megan, for what happened to you, but your intentions were good. And Gabe and I think you're a good person.
Yeah. Kindly, Connor and Gabe.
Yeah, kindly, Connor and Gabe. Please, all of you out there, keep sending us your emails. We love them. su@dw.com.
Und der Haifisch, der hat Zähne, und die trägt im Gesicht. Und McKeister hat ein Messer, doch das Messer sieht man nicht an einem schönen blauen Sonntag, liegt ein toter Mann am Strand und ein Mensch geht um die Ecke
Imagine you have two people standing right in front of you and they have just lost their jobs. And that's a very difficult situation for anyone who's experienced that. But one of these guys is going to have it pretty significantly worse than the other. He's going to see his health deteriorate at a faster clip and at a more severe clip than the guy standing next to him. Now, why would that be the case?
There is one difference between these two people. One is an immigrant, and the other one isn't.
Science Unscripted.
Hi, I'm Sylvia Loy. I'm a researcher at the Max Planck Institute for Demographic Research. And together with my colleagues, we have recently published a paper on how job loss affects the health of immigrants and non-immigrants differently.
So how does it affect immigrants and non-immigrants differently?
Well, first of all, we show that for those immigrants who have experienced job loss, we see a much faster health deterioration over the life course. So in other words, they are aging in poorer health. And also we observe that the consequences of losing a job are much worse for immigrants than non-immigrants.
How much worse, Sylvia?
Well, it's difficult to actually quantify it, but we show that there is a decline in health as people age. This is, of course, obvious for every one of us as we age. But for immigrants, we observe a much steeper decline.
What were the factors that you singled out as leading to these differences in health outcomes between Germans and immigrants when it comes to losing your job?
Well, this is a difficult question. We don't have a definite answer to that. So we don't really test what is the cause. We just observe and we describe that those who lose their job are immigrants are doing worse.
Can I speculate, Sylvia?
Can we discuss it?
Yeah, because I have 3 points in mind, and it starts with the job loss. If you're a migrant in a foreign country and you lose your job, you may have been earning less money to begin with. You may not have, you know, extra money in the bank to actually deal with the job loss or as much money in the bank. Secondly, you don't have, when you're unemployed, you don't have necessarily the big friend and family network, the extended network, maybe even the people you knew from growing up at school that you would have back at home. Hence, if you need to sleep on someone's sofa for a while, it's not quite as easy. And then it's time to get the job. And we all know that I think probably, again, I'm going out on a limb here, but in most countries, it's easier if you're a native born of that country to acquire a job than if you have migrated. I mean, it depends. It's more complex than that. But kind of 3 points there. You're in a worse spot when you lose your job. You don't have the network, and then it's harder to get the next job. Could that account for some of it, even most of it?
Yeah, absolutely. I believe these are all factors that taken separately, but especially taken simultaneously, are affecting these differentials that we observe. Absolutely. These are also the speculations that we provide in the paper, yes.
I'm sitting here with Connor. We are both migrants, migrant workers here. You're a migrant worker up in Rostock at the Max Planck Institute. Connor and I are sitting at this fancy institution, Deutsche Welle. Are we the same people that your study looked at, or are we in a different category than them?
You can be in there. I could be in there. But I wouldn't say the majority of immigrants are in that category.
And what is the difference between us and them then, I guess?
Well, first of all, I would assume that we have higher incomes. I would assume that for us, it will be much easier to find another job if we lose our job because we are high skilled. And I would also assume that we have much higher knowledge of the system, of the ways we can, in a way, restart our lives, which is also kind of soft skills that are hard to acquire in a foreign country. So these could be all elements that, in a way, for the majority of immigrants could be challenges.
This research, I think, hopefully has given a lot of people a little more empathy for what it means to be a migrant.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, migrants are not necessarily popular in a lot of countries. That's a fact.
Yeah.
People get angry. They yell at them. They some of them want them out of their country. It's terrible for them already. And then it turns out that their working conditions and health outcomes are even worse than ever. It's a really tragic situation. And I guess my question for you is, because this issue is so multifaceted and so complex, what is, like, if you were the Chancellor of Germany, what is one thing that you would immediately change to slightly improve what is a very difficult situation for them?
How can I say? So this is not a hard science where we can say, okay, we need to change A in order to have B. There needs to be more inclusion. There needs to be less discrimination. There needs to be higher incomes. There needs to be higher standard of living. There needs to be actions in order to prevent them to have these barriers to access the health systems. In reality, what we know is that immigrants do not really access these health systems because of a series of soft barriers.
Sylvia, you study this at the highest level, but at the personal level, do you feel like the migrants you study sometimes? Do you ever feel lost in this country in the way that I know Gabe does sometimes, and the way I do?
Well, sometimes I feel like the lack of an extended social network and especially family members is something hard, I would say. Yes, I had a child here some years ago, and it was also time of COVID. So that was a particular time in life when I felt being an immigrant in a foreign country, I mean, any foreign country, is a very, very hard thing to do, especially having important life events when you don't have the support around is very challenging.
And that was Sylvia Loy talking to us from Rostock, Germany, at the Max Planck Institute for Demographic Research, originally from Sardinia, Italy.
There was a big word that came up in there, discrimination. And if you guys want to know why we're talking about this topic right now, the German government publishes every year its annual discrimination report. And the number of complaints filed last year, as in 2023, was a 22% increase on the year before. And there was an increase on the year before that. And there, it seems like every year it's getting worse and worse and worse and more serious. And also, if you guys don't follow German news, there was a story that came out a few weeks ago. There was a nationwide survey of young Germans, aged 14 to 29. If there were an election right now for those young Germans, the AfD would win. And that is a far-right, Germany first, Germany's for the Germans kind of party. This is right now pretty serious.
Yeah. And as for the research itself, some of our listeners might be feeling like, well, complex topic, what can I do about it myself? I can't change this. Sylvia Loy didn't know how to change it. You don't have to, and you probably can't. The purpose is to elicit empathy, I think. Migrants have it rough. They're an easy scapegoat. And it helps knowing just how rough they have it. In this case, it's very specific, but it's something extra that you now know to understand their world a little better.
Regardless of how you feel about immigration.
Right? Totally. Yeah. And
Gabe, you can be against, for it, against it, whatever.
Yeah, and Gabe and I say this having migrated to this country.
We're immigrants.
To Germany. Do you have anything else to say on this? Any questions, comments, insights, personal anecdotes? Please send them to us, su@dw.com.
DW, made for minds.